Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. We have six cases on our docket for this afternoon, five of which are going to be orally argued. We're going to hear the first three and then take a break and then hear the last two. So in each case, the lawyers have asked for the full time. So for the third case up, I'm just giving you an idea of when, if you want to leave and come back, that'll be fine. So let's begin. To my right is Justice Sue Walker. To my left is Justice Lee Gabriel, and I'm Justice Sam Gardner. And we'll call the first case and go ahead and get started. Megan.
May it please the court, Mr. Christopher Nymar to argue for appellant and Mr. Richard Smith to argue for appellee.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I've got a bit of a wrinkle in today's case. I'll be using an iPad for my notes. I had a printer malfunction. So this should be interesting. First time to use an iPad. Again, I'd like to thank you for your time, and I'd like to thank the clerk's office for the 1:30 scheduling. I'll be able to make it home to Plano for my daughter's birthday party in time. As I was going over the case law that supports my client's appeal, I noticed that one of the key cases took 13 years to make it to the Supreme Court. I'm speaking of the Arnold v. National County Mutual case, the seminal case on insurance bad faith claims. That case laid the groundwork for some of what happened in the case this morning that you discussed in your 10:30 oral argument. Now, Mr. Arnold finally won through in that case, and given the 13-plus years it took, I think he must have made a decision much like my client has, Roger Parsons, to try every possible avenue to achieve justice, no matter how long it takes. Now, 4 years after Mr. Parsons' wife died, her company's jet hit a mountain in broad daylight on a clear day, a Texas jury came back with a finding that DuPont had been grossly negligent. Appellee Wendell Turley handled the case for Parsons. And as Dallas Court of Appeals Judge Bridges details in his 2003 opinion that dismissed Parsons' case, Turley didn't develop evidence on the pilot's alcohol abuse that would have supported punitive damages or any other supporting evidence. So the trial judge took one look at the jury's verdict on gross negligence and dismissed it. Overruled it. Now, when Judge Black overruled that verdict, he knew that Parsons would still be able to go after Turley for at least a portion of some of the damages that he should have gotten from DuPont. He knew that it was now Parsons' task to prove that Turley had evidence or could have developed evidence that supported gross negligence. Parsons wanted justice, so he hired another set of lawyers to sue Turley. He hired counsel 2 years in advance of the statute of limitations deadline that the Court of Appeals would later point to. But Parsons' first case against Turley was dismissed because his lawyers frittered away 2 years. And among other things, they failed to even try to serve process before that deadline that the Dallas Court of Appeals pointed to later. That second set of lawyers Motzenbacher and Greenberg, collected some pretty heavy legal fees over those 2 years. Turley's lawyers moved to dismiss for statute of limitations reasons. And then Parsons' lawyers continued to collect those fees while handling Parsons' appeal. Now, if you're in the trial judge's shoes on that first case that was dismissed for statute of limitations reasons, Parsons v. Turley, You've got two lawyers who filed Parsons' case just before the statute of limitations date expired. You have those two lawyers promising not to serve process, and in the midst of negotiating a settlement with the other side, They let the statute of limitations deadline pass without even trying to start a process. They missed it by a couple of months. Their major counter-argument in court later was to claim facts that supported enticement by opposing counsel. Now, Richter's decision was relatively easy. He was able to uphold a bright-line Rule 11. I mean, you have to get it in writing, lawyers, right? Punish Matzenbacher and Greenberg to some extent for their ineptitude, and still allow Parsons to collect on those claims because he could still get his damages. He just couldn't get them from Turley anymore. He had to go after those damages via Greenberg and Matzenbacher. The same thing goes for Judge Bridges when he affirms this decision in 2003. He could have made the decision to go with a second mandate that was in existence on the Parsons v. DuPont litigation. And based on that mandate, he could have given Roger Parsons a real trial against Wendell Turley. But he chose not to do that. And I think one of the reasons, again, is that Roger Parsons still had an avenue for collecting at least some of the portion of his damages that he should have gotten in the beginning. And one reason I think that is that Judge Bridges lays out a pretty clear case against Matzenbacher and Greenberg in his opinion that's pretty cut and dried. Details the mistakes they made, and the message is, Mr. Parsons, you can still get your damages, but you need to go after Greenberg and Matzenbacher. Now, after that case went down, Matzenbacher and Greenberg continued to serve as Parsons' lawyers. At no time did they ever say, hey, we screwed up. I think you should probably get out of counsel. There's a definite conflict here. And you know what? They owed him a fiduciary duty to inform him of the situation. But they didn't do that. Not only that, they dropped the four-year statute of limitations claims that had been pled against Turley, fraud and breach of fiduciary duty. Now, dropping those claims didn't make any sense, but it certainly made it easier for Turley. And to top it all off, Greenberg and Matzenbacher never argued for that second mandate date with the judge. Okay. The second mandate is there was a dispute as to the interest that had accrued on the claim and some controversy between Roger Parsons and Wendell Turley at any rate and with DuPont. So it was three-way. Roger Parsons worked it out with Wendell Turley, got their ducks in a row, and they appealed it. And that case actually came back down. I've got the mandate here in my hand right here, December 9th, 1998, which was actually, four months after? I mean, the mandate came down 4 months after that first mandate statute of limitations expired. So it is an interesting blip. But again, I think
I'm wondering if we can speed it up a little bit to fast forward to your current suit that's before us, which is again against Turley.
Of course.
And I don't mean to cut you off, but I'm curious to know as to how you got to back to suing Turley again.
Of course, ma'am. The rationale of my argument is that at each point when Parsons was poured out by each court, one of the attending rationales there was that Parsons could always move on to the next level. There was always another way.
Assume what Judge Bridges wrote what he wrote. why did the Judge Wilkinson err in granting the motion for summary judgment? Because that's all we're here to decide today, not why they did what they did years ago.
Yes, ma'am.
So, again, focus on this case and why that judgment is wrong.
Of course. The point is that for a constructive trust, an unjust enrichment constructive trust case to be in place, two things have to happen. One, you have to have unjust enrichment. And two, it has to be, I mean, these are the primary prongs. There are some other prongs that come into play. But one, the defendant has to be unjustly enriched. And the plaintiff, and it must have been at the plaintiff's expense. Well, it wasn't at Roger Parsons' expense until this June 11th, 2008 decision in the present case, a decision taken by Judge Davis, that Roger Parsons could no longer get those punitive damages from Greenberg and Motzenbacher. And so with that decision, the other shoe drops, and your constructive trust unjust enrichment case is essentially perfected. Until that point, because Roger Parsons has at-law claims that he can pursue against other attorneys, his equitable claim against Wendell Turley isn't on the table yet. Because, as I've outlined in my brief, Texas courts consistently deny plaintiffs the equitable avenue when they've got those at-law claims on the table. The reason for not pleading it in the alternative is because that unjust enrichment hadn't occurred yet.
Hadn't ripened,
it wasn't there yet.
Okay, I'm having a little bit of trouble there too with hadn't accrued, hadn't.
Good word.
Okay. Cause of action had not accrued?
Yes, ma'am. So, and I know we're sitting here, and probably everyone in this courtroom is sitting here thinking, well, that's a pretty novel idea, to say the least. But let me just say that the Arnold case that I started out with led to some pretty interesting developments. Arnold was later used by the Marino court to give the gentleman in Marino a second bite at the apple in a very curious twist of thinking. When the Supreme Court in Arnold gave Glenn Arnold a second chance to sue the same insurance company, the court itself really wasn't recognizing that there was a new cause of action in play. The only thing it did was say that, well, no, the statute of limitations for this is after the underlying claim has been fully adjudicated. So, Mr. Arnold, you do get to go to court, even though it's been 4.5 years since your accident. It's only been a year since the trial was decided, so you can go to court. Now, the case in Marino, they take that Arnold decision, and up to that point, you have statutory law. When you have new statutory law that creates a new right or a new cause of action that's been created by the legislature, plaintiff is allowed to come back for a second bite at that apple or for a different cause of action because it didn't exist before. Legislatures can create rights and duties and causes of actions out of whole cloth. But for the first time, the Marino Court decided to extend that to common law causes of action, which is a little strange because as I stand here today, I sincerely doubt that Mr. Arnold's lawyer ever argued that, hey, this is a brand new claim that I've got here. Breach of good faith, fair dealing, that's been around a long time. So the Marino Court saw, in the interest of getting Mr. Marino, a second chance at an insurance company that had done some bad things, decided to extend that recognition to statutory law, can create new rights, to common law as well. And that's the same thing I'm asking this court to do with regard to constructive trust. It's been done in the Gexa case. It's been done in Ginther v. Taub. The Minter case. There are a variety of Texas cases in which constructive trust has been asserted. And it certainly makes sense here.
Are the monies that you're saying should be in the constructive trust are still the punitive damages, correct?
In large part, yes, ma'am.
Okay. So if no court since the trial court has said that Mr. Parsons can recover punitive damages, how can those be in a constructive trust?
Well, the point is that before the decision that Parsons would not be able to get those punitive damages from this present set of lawyers, that was still essentially on the table. So yes, the court says that the court in the DuPont case and in the original Turley case, but for statute of limitations reasons, said that you can't come here for it, but it did not take it off the table, especially in that statute of limitations decision. It never reached the merits.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Rick Smith. I represent the appellees, Wendell Turley, and the law offices of Wendell Turley. The only issue that's before the court today that has to do with the causes of action on which summary judgment were granted is the constructive trust unjust enrichment sort of hybrid cause of action. It's the only one that's been appealed. That summary judgment that the trial court granted on that cause of action should be affirmed for numerous reasons, all of which are set forth in the brief, starting with the fact that the allegations that are made and the evidence that was developed on summary judgment don't satisfy even the most basic requirement of an unjust enrichment claim. Unjust enrichment requires a showing that one receive a benefit that it would be unjust for him to retain. And the basis of the unjust enrichment claim in this case is that the result in the Parsons versus Turley malpractice case was unjust, and that the Turley defendants have been unjustly enriched because they have retained the money that Mr. Parsons claims he should have recovered as damages in that malpractice case. As a matter of law, the result of that underlying malpractice case is not unjust. The decision was made at the trial court. It went to the Court of Appeals twice. And when it finally went to the Supreme Court, they denied the petition for review and they denied the motion for rehearing. So the very basis of this argument is that you can bring an unjust enrichment cause of action because you disagreed with a final, unappealable, over and done with result in a lawsuit.
But sorry to interrupt. Is he not claiming, though, that the unjust enrichment was because of the negligence of the second set of lawyers and failing to what they failed to do?
Yes, he is.
To entitle Turley to retain the benefits that Parsons now wants.
Yes, and, you know, of course, the Turley defendants don't take any position about whether or not the Motzenbacher, Mr. Motzenbacher and Mr. Greenberg did what they were supposed to do or adequately represented their client. And Mr. Parsons, in fact, brought suit against them. That's how this whole case got started. He sued Mr. Motzenbacher and Mr. Greenberg. That case went to trial. It was unsuccessful, and I think it is going to be the subject or is the subject of another appeal before this court. But whether or not he could ever recover against his lawyers in the malpractice case is a completely separate issue from whether or not his success or failure against the lawyers that represented him in the malpractice case could somehow give rise to a brand new opportunity, a second chance to go back and sue the same lawyer, the first lawyer, Mr. Turley, on the exact same claim, seeking the exact same damages, when that very claim and those very damages have already been determined, and it's been decided that he cannot recover them. So the first argument I'm making is that basically these claims don't even satisfy the basic element of an unjust enrichment claim. Now, what Mr. Parsons argues is that an unsuccessful litigant, in particular a plaintiff, should have really two opportunities if he doesn't succeed at the trial court. First, he can appeal the conventional appellate route all the way up to the Supreme Court if he wants to. He did that, and he lost. That should have been the end of it. But Mr. Parsons' theory in this case is that there is actually a second opportunity afforded a litigant that's not successful, and that is to simply go back and sue the original defendants again for the same claims, seeking the same damages, but this time change the name of what you're suing them for and call it unjust enrichment. That's all it is. And of course, there are numerous legal doctrines that would prevent a litigant from doing that. The three major ones that are discussed in the briefing are the doctrine of res judicata, the rules that prohibit an impermissible collateral attack on a judgment, and the statute of limitations. I'm going to address those three in, I hope, briefly in that order. As the court's familiar, doctrine of res judicata, it protects the sanctity of the rule that is the finality of judgments, that at some point all litigation has to come to an end. It prevents someone from relitigating a matter that has been finally adjudicated. That's exactly what this is. Whether or not he can recover this money from the Turley defendants has been finally adjudicated. He's now trying to do it again. And there are specific cases in Texas that say it's not good enough to simply rename your cause of action when you're trying a second time. That doesn't work.
His theory is he never got to the merits of that. It was never a decision on the merits of his original claim because it was dismissed for statute of limitations.
And I'll move straight to that issue, if the court please. The question of whether or not this is relevant both for res judicata and for the impermissible collateral attack argument, really it does boil down to, well, is that decision in the underlying malpractice action a final decision on the merits that is entitled to the preclusive effect of res judicata? Is that really, that's the issue. And Mr. Parsons argues that it's not, simply because it was decided on the statute of limitations. There is absolutely no authority for that proposition. There's none. In fact, it is directly contrary to the Texas Supreme Court's opinion in Igall that has really been discussed at length in both sides' briefing. And I won't go over the facts of that case too much, except to say that Mr. Parsons has spent a lot of time in the briefing arguing that it either doesn't say what it clearly says or that this court should just simply ignore what the holding in that case was. You know, that case was the payday claim case where you had a plaintiff that brought a cause of, he had two opportunities really, two options to pursue his payday claim. He could go through the administrative route or to the court system. He went to the administrative route and it was dismissed. And there were two grounds on which it was dismissed. First, the Court of Appeals held, well, on the merits, they've decided facts against you, which mean you can't recover. And in addition, the second ground was you failed to satisfy what is essentially a statute of limitations, 180-day limitation on filing those kinds of claims. And in trying to decide whether that underlying Texas Workforce Commission decision was entitled to preclusive effect under the doctrine of res judicata, the Supreme Court drew upon case law dealing with cases like this one, where you've got a case in court that you lose, and you try a second time to file another case in the same forum, the exact same forum, you know, not administrative in the courts, but just another court. And on that issue, it is unmistakable, page 90 of that opinion, the Supreme Court recognizes that a court's dismissal of a claim because of a failure to file within the statute of limitations is accorded preclusive effect. Could not be any clearer. They cite two Texas cases on it. They note the Fifth Circuit authority that is in accord with that. They specifically say, the Fifth Circuit has enunciated unequivocally that res judicata shall be given to a judgment dismissing a cause of action on limitations grounds. So there's no doubt about that particular premise. It's well settled. And in fact, the dissenting justices and the majority opinion in the Igall case They're not debating that issue. Nobody takes issue with that basic premise. Their argument was more whether that rule should apply when you've got a separate limitations period that applies in a different forum, like an administrative proceeding, and whether that should prevent somebody from going into another forum that might have a longer limitations period. And they drew analogies to states that have recognized that distinction. When you've got, for example, one state law, a case that fails because of limitations, and then is able to succeed in another state, another forum, because that forum might recognize a longer period of limitations. That is not what's at issue here. What's at issue here is whether or not you can sue in one court, lose, and then go to another court and avoid res judicata simply because the first decision was based on limitations. And clearly the answer to that is you cannot. And limitations really is sort of the catch-all argument that really defeats everything Mr. Parsons is trying to do in this case, even if you were to assume that there is some legitimate basis for alleging an unjust enrichment claim in this case, even if that were true, there's no doubt that the injury he's complaining of is the fact that he lost the malpractice case. He lost that malpractice case, and he was unable to get the damages he thought he should have received in that malpractice case. That's his injury. That injury occurred when he lost that case in 1999. That injury came to complete fruition when the Supreme Court denied the last motion to reconsider on the petition. That was in 2004. Mr. Parsons did not try this against the Turley defendants, this case, until December of 2008. It's way too late under the applicable two-year statute of limitations. It's even too late under a four-year statute. And the only argument he makes to try to avoid that is this accrual argument that was discussed earlier in the presentation. And there's just simply no basis for that position, that this claim of unjust enrichment would not accrue until he is unsuccessful in pursuing a completely separate malpractice claim against a completely separate set of lawyers. The law couldn't be clearer. That cause of action, if it ever existed, accrued when you were injured, when you lost the original malpractice case. There are only two other issues that are raised in the briefing, neither of which I believe were adequately briefed. One was the decision to strike some summary judgment evidence, and the other one was the denial of the motion to disqualify Judge Wilkinson from hearing the case. I don't believe either one of those have been adequately briefed. The decision to strike the evidence, there's no argument in the brief pointing out why any of that evidence should have resulted in a different decision by the court. There's absolutely no explanation in the briefing as to why the decision to deny the motion to disqualify Judge Wilkinson was an abuse of discretion. So I don't think either one of those would be a basis for reversing the decision.
Did she actually rule on that motion to disqualify?
No, that was another judge, and I cannot remember who did it now. It was so long ago. But it was raised, and she appropriately, as she's she has to either grant it or refer it out, and she referred it out. And there was an evidentiary hearing for an afternoon, and it was denied. So the Turley defendants are here today asking this court to hopefully finally put an end to the campaign of litigation against them, which began 12 years ago. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
All right, first I'd like to address the notion that you can't file a second claim that tries to recoup something on the order of the same monetary label of damages. Not putting that very well. But in the Marino case, Marino brought that action that that the court gave him a chance to bring in the second action against the insurance company. He brought it the first time. He brought it in the form of a DTPA, Commerce Code, and Insurance Code action. He even argued the evidence before the jury. And he elected not to go to the jury on the jury charge for that part of his claim. He just went with the contract action. So in that case, Mr. Marino himself didn't get those damages in the first suit, could have gotten them potentially if he'd done the gone all the way through the jury charge process, but didn't. And then the Supreme Court says, well, okay, the Arnold Court created an entirely new cause of action, and Marino gets to use that. And that's a pretty powerful example of how it's not necessarily the case that having tried once to access a particular amount of damages, that door is forever closed to you. Because it was certainly opened again in the Marino case.
I have a question. In Marino, the court created the cause of action. In other cases, the statute has created a cause of action, but no court has created a cause of action in this case. New cause of action. So how does that relate? How are those cases analogous? How is Marino analogous to this case?
The analogy lies in that it is the Judge Davis's action, his decision, that brings that claim to fruition. That the unjust enrichment constructive trust. So it's decisional law. It's a judge making a decision that has a pretty far-reaching impact globally on Roger Parsons' entire list of causes of action. The res judicata issue is a sticky one, and again, as counsel mentioned, we've briefed it intensively on both sides. Let me just say that it isn't necessary to use res judicata to stop someone who's been poured out via statute of limitations from filing a second claim. Collateral estoppel does that. Collateral estoppel, issue preclusion, means that the point at which that statute of limitations began to run and the length of the statute of limitations have been decided. So for Mr. Plaintiff, who tries to go to the next lawsuit and argue against that, he can't. He's stopped. Collateral estoppel. Collateral estoppel does not require a final adjudication on the merits. So when we employ a collateral estoppel in that situation, we don't have to deal in legal fictions that say, oh, well, a statute of limitations claim is an adjudication on the merits for the purposes of res judicata. What does that mean? And why go there if you don't have to, if you have a tool like collateral estoppel to do that? Not only that, I'd ask the court to remember that this constructive unjust enrichment constructive trust claim could not have been brought in that first action to begin with, and that's the third prong for res judicata. So Turley's res judicata argument fails for those two reasons and for some other ones I mentioned in my brief. Finally, the Egal decision. Let me see if I can. In the Egal decision, it sounds like the Egal court has its main opinion, and then at the end it throws in an even if argument, kind of a rhetorical device for the dissenting justices, and it says even if Egal wasn't decided on the merits, the SOL decision gets us there. And you think, whoa, are they about to say that a statute of limitations decision is an adjudication on the merits? But if you look at that last sentence, it says, the Texas Workers' Commission dismissal of Egal's claims under the deadline provision in the code is a denial of the claim to which res judicata attached when, as here, the claim is pursued to final judgment. Egal got his trial before the commission. That didn't happen here. And so that argument doesn't work here either.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments and your briefs. It's a very interesting, complex case. Your case is submitted, and you'll be hearing from the court. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.